From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Baby, oh baby, genetic testing on embryos is giving birth to a new generation of children free from life-threatening diseases like cancer or early-onset Alzheimer's. In this hour, is this a godsend or the latest step toward creating designer babies? The ethical and emotional debate. Begin with an extraordinary breakthrough in Chicago, where doctors helped a 30-year-old woman give birth to a baby who is free of her family's curse of early Alzheimer's disease. Dr. Yuri Verlinsky is director of the Reproductive Genetics Institute that performed the procedure. Earlier, I asked him to tell us about his patient and what he did to help her.
This patient has a family history with early onset Alzheimer's disease.
Early onset Alzheimer's, meaning the Alzheimer's that may come as early as the mid-30s?
40 years.
40s, okay.
Mm-hmm. This family was studied and was discovered they have mutation for, it's called V717L mutation, what is in 24, chromosome 21, and it's almost 100% penetrant for in this family.
So it's a chromosomal mutation that would cause, would be likely
gene
to
mutation,
cause...
Gene mutation.
I see. That would cause early onset Alzheimer's.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
And the woman wanted to have a baby.
Yes. Well, the woman came to us. She wanted to have a baby, and she has two options. Mm-hmm. To go ahead and have a baby and go through prenatal and terminate the pregnancy if it's going to be carry a mutation.
If it's going to carry the mutation that would also leave the child with the same problem.
Right, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Or go through pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, diagnosis disease before implantation, using in vitro fertilization, when we can have in our hands the number of embryos where we can select which one of them carry a mutation, which one is not, and transfer only once who don't have a mutation.
So you were able to take out the eggs, examine them, withdraw those that had the mutation that would cause early Alzheimer's,
right,
and re-implant those that did not have the genetic problem.
Right.
And then it's an in vitro fertilization?
In vitro fertilization. So we did analysis of these embryos and transfer only one who didn't have mutation. It was like 13 eggs, 7 was abnormal, mm-hmm, 6 was normal. Mm-hmm. We transfer 4 and get one normal baby.
Has the baby yet been born, Dr. Verlinsky?
Baby is born. Baby is 1.5 years old.
And are you perfectly confident that this child will not be vulnerable to early onset Alzheimer's as a result of your genetic procedure?
Yes.
Wow. Are there any implications for the mother? Does it mean anything to her health?
It doesn't mean anything to her health.
Except that she'll have the confidence that the child will not grow up with the same threat of Alzheimer's that she faces.
Right.
You're at the forefront of what you describe as pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. The essence of that is pulling out the egg, I guess, in advance to examine it for flaws.
Right.
And to remove those, the genetic material, or the egg in this case, that carries the flaw.
Right.
What other kinds of things might you screen for? In this case, it was early onset Alzheimer's. Are there other genetically related diseases that you could screen for?
Absolutely. We already have experience with screening more than 60 different single gene disorders, more than 100 different mutations. We have more than 250 baby born after this procedure.
And what kinds of diseases have been avoided through this procedure?
You name it. It's the most common genetic disorders such as cystic fibrosis, thalassemia, Tay-Sachs, sickle cell anemia. It's chromosomal abnormalities. We can talk about the late onset disorders. We did with Li-Fraumeni syndrome to prevent cancer, mm-hmm, gene P53 deficient gene. We did a lot of different things using this new technology and pre-implantation genetic diagnosis.
Dr. Verlinsky, you describe such a wide range of diseases that you've already been able to
prevent through this genetic intervention. Can you imagine a time when this becomes a standard procedure, that every mother would want to go through this pre-implantation screening to look out for any kind of potentially genetically carried disease problem?
We now offer to every couple or every family who carry already defined genetic disorders to go through pre-implantation genetic diagnosis to make sure they will not have a baby affected with disease. So we're already doing this.
And what if the parents should come to you and the issue that they want to prevent is not necessarily a defined disease? Maybe they don't want their child to have as much, I don't know, facial hair or something else. Can you screen for things other than disease, and do you do that?
No.
Could you do that?
No.
Why not?
The answer is, it's two answers to it. First of all, we decide we are not going to do anything that is not involved with, not with disease, because we call this pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. And so, second thing, I think it's the future, what you're describing, it's not single gene defect. So we cannot do for the not single genes or not chromosomal disease.
I see. So this is only working...
It's a multifactorial issue. It's not involved in the structure of the genes, and maybe in function of the genes and environment also.
So you're looking at situations where it's an isolated aspect that can be easily seen as related to a disease and therefore removed.
Yes.
Can you imagine a misuse of this procedure, Dr. Felinski?
What we're doing, I think it's the earliest diagnosis of the most difficult disease to be treated or impossible to treat. And the earliest diagnosis is give a tool to prevention medicine. And prevention medicine is the best medicine available. But misused, I think you can misuse everything. You know, that's different things.
Dr. Yuri Verlinsky is director of the Reproductive Genetics Institute in Chicago. It's a brave new world out there for prospective parents. Genetic tests are diagnosing potential health problems in the petri dish and giving new hope to couples who want a family guaranteed against genetic disease. But could this technology lead to a society where imperfections are no longer tolerated? What about testing for Ivy League brains or Olympic figure skating potential? Are we ready for designer babies? Do you have a personal experience to share? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining us now from New York is Barbara Katz-Rothman, sociologist at the City University of New York and author of The Book of Life, A Personal and Ethical Guide to Race, Normality, and the Implications of the Human Genome Project. Good evening and welcome, Barbara Katz-Rothman.
Good evening.
Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Also with me in the studio is tonight's guest news analyst, Juliet Kayyem, head of the Domestic Preparedness Program at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, formerly a lawyer with the U.S. Justice Department. Good evening. Welcome, Juliet.
Good evening.
Barbara Katz-Rothman, this news today sounds like a touching story and a great relief for the parents. They will now have... an infant that will not carry the gene that causes early onset Alzheimer's. It must be a huge relief to them. What's wrong with this picture, if anything?
Yeah, you know, it doesn't pay to start talking about what's wrong with this picture. And of course, it's a good thing for a child not to have a terrible disease. There's no question about that. I think the issues aren't even necessarily the ones about, picking perfect eye color or frivolous uses or whatever.
So are we just we're on the right path here. This is the way to go. We should be screening.
Well, that's the interesting thing about what is the path. We know already that all of us carry a number of potentially lethal genes, that each and every one of us have genetic defects that will cause cancers and diabetes and all kinds of horrible things, including late Alzheimer's, which is no joy either. And that many of these conditions have genetic components. We haven't got a technology that's able to do any treatment, as the doctor pointed out. We can only prevent people who carry these potentials from becoming people,
from being born.
People. I don't want to say people. I mean, you can only choose eggs to fertilize or choose fertilized eggs to implant that are free of any given defect that you want to find. the trick is that if we know that we each carry several disease genes, you know, genes that are potentially could cause some horrible disease, mm-hmm. once you can test for all of them, then everybody will get the news that, well, this child has twice the odds of bladder cancer of most children, or five times the odds of this disease, that disease, Alzheimer's in the 70s, not the 40s, whatever, that we'll be speaking in probabilities, but every child will be born carrying some kind of lethal, horrible, awful disease you don't want your child to have.
Well, but Barbara Katz-Rothman, is that the case, or might we someday get to a point where we will sort at the egg level so that no child would be born?
But that's what I'm saying. Since every human being carries these potential genes,
yeah.
then what is it you're talking about? Who is it that you can give birth to? The perfect person that doesn't exist? Do we find some perfect person that's lived to 120?
You may have a medical insight that we don't. Are you saying that in this case that we're talking about today, they found the eggs that carried the mutation, they took those off the table, they didn't fertilize them, so they
right.
never, so they won't be born? Could we do that right across the board? So that you only chose eggs that had no genetic mutations or defects that would lead to genetically...
There aren't any. That's what I'm saying.
It's impossible.
We each carry genes that have the potential for causing horrible things to happen to
us. And every single egg is going to carry some of those.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So that you will end up with a kind of situation where we're saying, well, this egg has a very high risk of diabetes, and this one has a real high risk of heart disease, and this one, Alzheimer's, and this one, something else. Which one do you want?
But Barbara Katz-Rothman, can't you imagine that being kind of like a trip to the auto dealership, where people will, in fact, sit down with that list and decide, we want egg number 6 because we'd rather run the 60% risk of diabetes than the 70% risk of cancer?
That's right. That's the kind of thing that you're talking about. An infinite number of diseases, an infinite number of probabilities, sorting through them, making a decision, and then in an interesting kind of way, feeling responsible, of course, if you make mm-hmm. the wrong decision and you've got the kid who indeed develops the cancer.
Well, are we hyperventilating about a science fiction possibility, or could this become a reality in the next few years as genetics continues to rapidly develop?
We've got hundreds of, mm-hmm. We've mapped the genome. We've already got mm-hmm. hundreds of these associated with various, quote, defects and genetic problems and potentials.
They've already used it to...
Mostly not like this one, where mm-hmm. almost everybody ends up in a very severe situation. Mm-hmm. Most of them are, you have double the odds, five times the chances, whatever, of some cancer over the course of your life. You don't know that this gene is going to specifically bring this condition in this many years. Most of them are more variable than that, but they're still serious, and they're really scary to be looking at when you're going to be responsible for the child born with that condition.
But the technique has been used to prevent already hemophilia, sickle cell anemia, muscular dystrophy, Huntington's disease, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
In that case, it's prevention. It's not just odds.
Well, it's preventing the odds. I mean, people with these conditions, and when you go through the whole list of them, they're not always quite as clear-cut as this. So mm-hmm. somebody develops one of these conditions, but it could be earlier, it could be later, it could mm-hmm. be more severe, it could be less severe. Mm-hmm. They're not all of the diseases that we're able to test for now are, the word that he used was penetrance.
Mm-hmm.
If you have the gene, you have the disease almost
right.
always.
Right. Juliet Kayyem, I want to turn to you just before the break. Mm-hmm. If this becomes available, can you see Americans resisting it? Or will we have a kind of social, you know, must-do if the neighbors have done?
It's less must-do if the neighbors have done than enormous pressure to feel like you've done everything that you can for your child.
And Barbara, can't stand by. I want to put that same question to Juliet Kayyem here in the studio.
Well, I actually think Barbara's probably right. And what we need to examine here is where we're going to draw the line in between giving the woman in the case that was released today, who's going to have this drastic disease and doesn't want to give it to her child, the opportunity to have a child, to the designer babies. And the question is not only where is that line going to be drawn, but who's going to draw it, the medical community, the government, or each individual person.
And maybe should the woman be having a child? She herself is likely to be into dementia and maybe death by age 42. That's when her father died. We're talking about designer babies and the line between appropriate use of genetics and an inappropriate use. Do you see any problem with genetic intervention to shape our babies? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about designer babies. The word is out today that a child has been spared early onset Alzheimer's disease by genetic intervention, even before fertilization of the egg. How far might all this go? Do you think it's the right thing to spare the child in this case? And what else may be coming down the pike? Is this good modern medicine or man playing God? Where are we headed here? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined by Barbara Katz-Rothman. She's a sociologist at the City University of New York. And now by George Annis. He's professor of health law, bioethics, and human rights at Boston University's School of Public Health. Good evening and welcome, George Annis.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. Dr. Annis, what are the issues here, ethically speaking?
I think the issues actually have been pretty well put by Barbara.
Mm-hmm.
And then the question is, how far do we want to go? I don't think this particular case is much of a problem. It's hard to see anything wrong with screening at the egg level, especially. I mean, some people object to destroying embryos that are, quote, defective, but I know of no one who objects to destroying eggs. Or we can't screen sperm, but if we could screen sperm, to destroying sperm. And it's obviously much better to have a child without early Alzheimer's than with it.
Even there, you know, this, of course, was published, the story of this whole procedure was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association by Dr. Yuri Verlinsky, who we spoke with earlier. And in the accompanying article, we have two doctors, ethicists, pointing out that this mother, because she does carry the gene, most likely will not be able to care for or even recognize the child in a few years. And these doctors say, you know, this mother would not be eligible to adopt a child by typical standards in the United States. Should she be going through a procedure that will let her have a child in any case? Is that an ethical issue or not?
It's a different ethical issue. Sure,
it is.
It's an ethical issue. Who should have children? So far, we've, you know, at least since our bad experiences with government-sanctioned sterilization, we've reacted quite strongly against that and said that's a decision that parents have to make, individuals have to make, that the government can't make that decision.
Even if they know they're not going to be around to raise it, it's their decision.
We don't license parents. Mm-hmm. We don't know they're not going to be around. It's a high probability.
At this point, we've allowed men who died already are dead.
Yeah, well, that's ridiculous.
Sperm harvested so that they can become, quote, fathers.
Right, so I guess we've crossed that frontier.
We do let dead people so-called, you know, have their sperm used, but that I think is a significant mistake. There's no point to have dead people. Dead people can't do anything or have any interest, and we shouldn't let their children be born with dead fathers when we can avoid it.
So we're not begrudging the mother here tonight, or we're not really going into that ethical issue, but the ethics...
It's a matter of begrudging when judging. We're not going to judge that woman's decision.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough. Fair enough.
On the other hand, for the doctor to say, well, it's a woman's decision and I have nothing to do with it, is a little too cavalier. I mean, medicine is on the verge of becoming a total consumer good, but we like to think that there is such a thing as a medical indication for a medical procedure, and the doctors exercise some judgment, that you don't just get something because you show up at the door with some money and desire. That money and desire together...
Mm-hmm.
Are insufficient, it seems to me, to qualify for a medical procedure.
Well, that raises the whole issue of drawing lines here, boundaries. George Annis, can you describe boundaries that you might suggest for how this be applied? And are there any laws that cover application of genetic screening currently?
There's no laws, and there are actually no professional standards. And I think that we definitely need professional standards, but the reason there aren't any is because the line is so hard to draw. Mm-hmm. The basic line is the one... That was drawn by the doctor here, which was a serious condition,
mm-hmm.
Single gene genetic serious condition. Tay-Sachs obviously qualifies, thalassemia, cystic fibrosis probably, early on Alzheimer's does, but what about late Alzheimer's?
Mm-hmm.
What about cancer at some point, or heart disease, or all these a lot of diseases which, if you have any faith in medicine at all, you have to think in 30 or 40 or 50 years, we should have some new treatments for these things, at least be able to alleviate them, if not cure them.
Well, what about cancer, for example? People have put an awful lot of effort into avoiding it. If it could be somehow screened out before birth, in your view, George Ennis, is that a good idea?
Well, it depends what we're talking. If we're talking about very early cancers, you can make an argument. But I think that's a bad idea. I think that's silly. Then we're getting to Barbara's point that you get a whole bunch of things wrong with this embryo. We're only screening one thing out. The reason we're doing it now, in the cases it's being done, is because there's a family history of it. You have brothers and sisters who have
this.
It's
really hard to find the line. I mean, you have these families that say, well, you know, we have a history of breast cancer or some other cancer in our family, and no, it doesn't have 100% penetrance, but it's scary.
So what are you suggesting, Barbara Katz-Rothman, that we can't draw a line? Or
I think we're not going to be able to draw a line at the level of the individual, so we have to be asking ourselves, how come we're putting our energy in this direction? I mean, why do we think that this is a good way for medicine to be going and growing? We've been funding genetic research and genetic testing of various sorts for a really long time, always being told that there's some cure to something around the corner, but so far, all we've gotten is a lot of screening. And every time we say, oh, yes, we must consider the ethical, legal, and social implications, and usually that's sort of like we point to the box in the corner where we've put them and say, someday we're going to have to worry about that.
So we should worry about it now. I don't disagree with you.
But George,
yeah, that doesn't mean you stop doing this
like
type of screening.
Soon we're going to have a problem.
Yeah. George Annis is saying we should draw a line. Barbara Katz-Rothman, as I understand, you're suggesting we shouldn't even be doing this stuff.
I'm less suggesting that we shouldn't be doing this and saying, where does this fit in our priorities? In a country in which the chances of a child surviving its first year, let alone living a long lifespan, are better predicted by the mother's zip code than her medical history.
By which you mean her economic status.
Her socioeconomic status, in which we have so many babies, right, you know, in your listening area, being born with no medical insurance, with lousy housing, with inadequate nutrition available to them, that this is what we think is very important to talk about. This is served up with your morning coffee in the newspaper. This gets an hour of radio time. This is the important thing. This is where we think, oh, here we have ethical dilemmas. That babies are dying of poverty isn't perceived as an ethical dilemma. It's perceived as some kind of fact of life.
Well, it's been on page one in recent days with new studies out about infant mortality, but you're quite right. This somehow is more fascinating. Juliet Kayyem, is this an example of American fascination with technology and gizmos? Are we looking at the wrong thing here? And I guess, more personally, if this mother had come to you for advice and said, I want to have a baby. I don't want it to have the same early onset Alzheimer's that afflicted my sister, my brother, killed my father at 42. Would you have advised her to go ahead and have this procedure or not?
I would agree with George. I don't think that this is a hard case, this specific case. I mean, just given the decision to have a child is so personal, and clearly she, at least in the news report so far and in the journal report, you know, she and her husband had thought about it for a long time. This was not something that they jumped into. So then the question is, why? And I also don't disagree with Barbara that there are all these other issues out there that will have an impact on a child's well-being, that maybe we are so fascinated with DNA and genetic testing. But I want to raise an issue regarding the line drawing, because it is so difficult, and we don't know who should make it. And Barbara and George can speak better to the medical community. I can talk about the government and that kind of line drawing, if there's a role for the government in this. It seems to me that there are a lot of things that the government can do without drawing these lines about when is a disease bad enough that you would permit a person to select.
Now, what do you mean without drawing these lines then?
Things the government can do on the sort of post-birth end that will have an impact and make people's lives better, even if they're not genetically perfect. In other words, in this country, there is
health insurance, public health, and so on.
Or even, I mean, in this country, there's not a lot of gender selection, or at least my understanding that there's not a lot of gender selection. Why not? My guess is because it's pretty good to be a woman in this country. And
relatively speaking.
Relatively speaking. And there may be problems, but, you know, Title IX mm-hmm. and equal pay and all these things that government can do to sort of make the consumer, the parent, believe that they're not getting the second wind.
It's a very good example you're using, because oftentimes people act as if, oh, sex selection, that's a misuse of the technology.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Something like Down syndrome, that's a good use. If you had your choice of being born the child of fabulously wealthy Americans mm-hmm. with Down syndrome, or the fourth daughter of very, very poor people in a country that does not support its daughters, who do you think you'd rather be? Who would have the better life? So to say, you know, this is a serious medical...
If you really know both those circumstances, that's not an easy question to answer.
It isn't an easy question. Yeah.
Barbara Katz-Rothman, George Annis, Juliet Kime, stand by. We have so many callers, I want to begin to bring them in. Karen is on the line. Welcome, Karen. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Good to have you.
I think this is a great conversation, and unfortunately, was stuck in the middle of all this personally, because we're halfway there. Most of us who are over 35 and have children have the choice of having amniocentesis, which I did.
Right. Halfway there, meaning, are you pregnant, Karen?
Well, I am again, but I had a horrible experience because the amnio, and they told me that there was a genetic problem with my child, mm-hmm. but we're halfway there because they couldn't tell me exactly what that genetic disease was going to turn out to be.
Right.
So they doubled my risk and gave me a lot of very scary scenarios, but in the same time they said, or your child could have nothing wrong.
How did you respond?
We actually ended up terminating the child because we have a son who's already got a lot of difficulties.
So would you have been more comfortable if you had had pre-implantation genetic diagnosis?
Absolutely, because I actually had to terminate at 6 months.
That's
because
tough.
Because by the time they give you amnio and you have the whole discussion and figure out what you want to do as a family, it's very late.
Well, Karen, you bring it right down to the very personal reality. Barbara Katz-Rothman, how do you respond? Here's Karen's case.
I interviewed so many women in exactly that situation. Mm-hmm. I had done a book a long time ago called The Tentative Pregnancy about the experience of people who were pregnant but maybe not having a baby because they were waiting for the results of their amnio. And people found that once they got, we can't say there's something wrong, but maybe there's something wrong, they were afraid to finish the pregnancy. They'd be even more afraid to implant that egg. That was the point I was making before, because each baby is going to come with, well, this one might have this and that one might have that. It's really going to be scary to give birth to any of them.
Yeah, but isn't that seems a little bit too easy. I mean, we're all prepared to put up with something, but to put up with a clear and present threat or reality of a severe problem for an infant.
Picture yourself being told that your child has twice the chance or five times the chance of developing bladder cancer as children normally do.
Mm-hmm.
Picture yourself making the decision, and what does it mean to have a child who, you know, gets a bladder infection, and what are you thinking and what are you doing and what are you blaming yourself as you wait to see what this is?
Karen, let me put that to you, Karen.
If
a whole series of probabilities were laid out before you, would you rather have that than the stark? You had probabilities laid before you, but your only response was to choose to go ahead or to terminate.
Right, I think it depends on the person. I'm the kind of person that needs very matter of fact information, and I've just felt that it was so vague, and I was terrified that something was going to be terribly, terribly wrong. Especially since I'm already challenged with a child who actually has a different genetic mutation, which, of course, they told me I'm 1 in 4 million people that have that issue.
Mm-hmm.
So we just said we have to start all over, and we did, and we're actually due, and this baby has no problems. So, but I had to wait. I had to go through that whole waiting process
again
to make sure that this was okay.
Mm-hmm.
So if I could have done this way earlier, I think I just would have, the stress on the whole family would have been much better.
Karen, thank you very much for your call. And we can hear in Karen's voice the American citizen ready to line up for this genetic screening if it becomes widely and easily available. Arch is on the line. Welcome, Arch. You're on the air.
Thank you. I want to take a slightly different view, and I want to object or observe the semantics of this discussion.
Please do.
Because you find yourself saying that a disease has been prevented. In fact, what has been prevented is a person who may or may not have the disease. And in the final analysis, we have any numbers of millions of people with those diseases living productively in the United States, and many of them, if not most of them, and in probably most of them happily and productively.
Mm-hmm. And in spite of disease.
Cure for disease by the elimination of the people who have the diseases greatly devalues the people who are currently living with those diseases.
Mm-hmm.
And the concept that if you have a high probability of having a genetic disorder, mm-hmm. you are therefore not worthy of living,
yes.
is a very serious semantic problem.
Yeah, well taken point. George Annis, what about this? Are we moving toward a kind of intolerance of imperfection when human beings are, as Barbara Katz-Rothman and Arch point out, are flawed? Some are very flawed and still find richly fulfilling lives.
Well, a couple of things. First, in this case, there were no human beings. There were no even embryos that were screened. We were screening eggs. You know?
Yes.
And none of those eggs were going to be people. So we don't.
Well, we understand how that fits into the abortion argument, but
right.
at some metaphysical level, this might have been a person if it were.
But the issue of, you know, are we becoming intolerant of imperfections is a very important one. And I take the point made before that we need a society with laws like the Americans with Disabilities Act to protect people with disabilities and to try to break down discrimination. We don't want to do things that reinforce discrimination and make life harder. We should really have the prospect that we're all equal, we're all the same, we're all humans, and that genetic differences should not be material in the way we treat each other.
It's laws and it's other kinds of support, too. I mean, I remember interviewing a woman once who had very thorough counseling after she learned that the fetus that she carried had Down syndrome, and she was trying to decide what to do, and she learned that they'd been cutting back the programs in special ed in her community. And the services just weren't going to be there, the basic services that she needed to raise a child with Down syndrome.
And yet, I want to bring Arch back in here. Arch, I don't know if you know the details, but the woman who did make this decision about the baby who might well have had early onset Alzheimer's, her father died at 42 with serious problems, psychological, memory, and Alzheimer's related. Her brother got it at 35, her sister at 38. I mean, this was not a laughing matter. I mean, I don't. Of course, you're not suggesting that, but this life might well have ended in a very, very difficult way. Are you saying go ahead anyway and just deal with it? That's life.
Well, I agree with your guess in the fact that this particular case is a relatively clean case, and I understand that we were not talking about a progressing embryo here, but I am speaking of the semantics of the thing, because it tends to be that says if you can eliminate the creation of people who have genetic disorders, that is an unalterable good to society. I argue with that. I argue also with the fact that if your child, productive, creative, loving, educated, contributing child was killed in an automobile accident at 35, does it then follow that it would have been better that they never existed?
Well, we're deep into metaphysics here. Arch, thank you very much for your call. We're coming up on another break. Juliet Kayyem, this is right at the rock face of the genetic future that we're facing.
Absolutely. I mean, the last point that Art, I believe his name was, just made was right. And I think that also applies to the mother in this case. There's no problem with the fact that she may get very ill in her 30s. In my perspective, she also has a husband who can care for the child.
Do we need to draw boundaries here? Limits to what will and won't be done? Join us, 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about designer babies, about genetic screening to spare children from genetically transmitted diseases. But it gets very complicated very quickly. What do you think? Are you comfortable with doctors, with parents designing babies to spare them from genetic disease, to enhance them for non-medical reasons? Is this good modern medicine or man playing God? Is this the future or is this dangerous? We're joined by Barbara Katz-Rothman. She's a sociologist at the City University of New York, by George Annis. He's professor of health law, bioethics, and human rights at Boston University, by our guest analyst, Juliet Kayyem, and right now by Dr. David Sable. David Sable is director of the Division of Reproductive Endocrinology and Infertility at St. Barnabas Medical Center in New Jersey. Good evening and welcome, Dr. David Sable.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening in on our conversation, Doctor.
I have.
You work right in the thick of all this. What's your reaction to the conundrums and the ethical dilemmas being laid on the table here?
Well, I think we're, in terms of the technology we have available right now, we're making this much more complex than we need to.
Okay.
I think the procedure that's being used right now, the procedure that we're talking to in this particular case, is very much in line with mainstream medicine. That is, we're trying to relieve and prevent suffering. This is a young lady and a young man who decided to have a child. Knowing their genetic history, they had the opportunity to take steps to prevent that child from suffering later in life, and I see nothing inconsistent between that and most of what all of us accept as good in medicine.
But Dr. Sable, what we've heard here this evening, I guess if you boil it down, is in some sense that suffering is part of human life, and if we try to iron out every wrinkle at the very basic originating point, at the genetic level, we're just fighting the reality of an imperfect world, of imperfect human life.
Well, I tell my patients all the time, and only half-jokingly, that we are all nothing but the sum of our own abnormalities. However, we can, some of these abnormalities we can choose to prevent, and some of them are at the tip of the bell curve where the amount of suffering involved is extraordinary. And we are an intelligent species. We as people are intelligent, and we have individuals who are intelligent. They can draw on their own experience. They can draw on the technologies, its strengths and limitations, and make very wise decisions as to how to use them.
You're doing cutting-edge pre-implantation genetic diagnosis at St. Barnabas. Give us a sense of the women, the men who come to you seeking help. What are the emotions, the issues they're coming to you with?
Well, we have couples coming to us with many aspects. In some cases, the pre-implantation genetics, or PGD as we abbreviate it, is a help towards getting an infertile couple pregnant. We have many couples where many of the embryos they create are just genetically incompatible with life, and we need this testing in order to find those that are compatible with life. That's a very basic form. We have others who come to us with histories of habitual miscarriage, 6, 7, 8 pregnancy losses in a row at various times during the pregnancy, and we can prevent that type of uncertainty and suffering during the pregnancy.
All right, so those are fertility or impregnation issues, carrying to term issues, and how about disease issues?
Correct. In terms of disease issues, couple of the most basic forms of disease that we use this procedure to diagnose are things that are called sex-linked. Originally, when the test was developed, it was very rudimentary, and we could check just a couple of the presence or absence of some of the chromosomes, including X and Y. And some families have diseases where if a male offspring is born, it'll have a 50% probability of a very, very intense suffering and a very early death. And originally, this procedure was used to choose female embryos for implantation. Now, I want to differentiate this from what people call a sex selection for family balance.
We want a baby girl, we want a baby boy.
Yeah, correct. That's not at all what we're talking about. Again, we're preventing suffering and trying to prevent disease. We're getting much more sophisticated now insofar as we can take an egg prior to fertilization and determine whether that egg carries the predisposition for a certain disease, as in this case, and then choose not to fertilize that egg. And this is right now the more cutting edge of the field.
Barbara Katz-Rothman, you hear Dr. David Sable saying this is simply preventive medicine. We're preventing suffering. What's your thought on that view?
I'm all in favor of preventing suffering, too. You know, don't try to turn it into, you know, either we go full blast ahead with the technology or we make babies suffer.
Yeah, but I hear you essentially suggesting that this is not.
Listen to what he's also saying, that we can find genes that predispose towards disease and prevent suffering. Now, we know that what we're finding are some of these single gene disorders that are very dramatic, but we also know that we're finding disease involvement with genes that are less dramatic, like, you know, diabetes or whatever. And it's going to be very hard for us to make decisions about line drawing. And what we're saying, what I hear being said repeatedly is, well, we're not there yet. We can't really do anything that complicated, or we're not really doing that yet, so we don't have to think about it now. I think we do have to think about it now, that we do, as not in terms of making laws and saying, you may not do that, I'm going to stop you, We have to be making laws as moral laws. We have to be thinking about it as a people. What is it that we want? What is it that parents owe their children? What do we owe each other as a community? What kinds of support and help can we give people in difficult situations rather than start blaming each other?
Mm-hmm. David Sable, you're a practitioner. Would you welcome some line drawing here? Are you ready for boundaries? Do we need them?
Well, I think there's always boundaries. I draw boundaries myself. You know, I am approached often by couples that ask me to do pre-implantation genetics in order to provide a boy or a girl.
But is that good enough to know that you personally do that? There may be another doctor who's ready to create just whatever you want.
Well, these are things I agree that it's proper to discuss these things. Mm-hmm. It's proper to try to decide as a society or as a group how to approach this. I think what we need to do, though, is to start with the individuals involved and start with a basic question. What is our mission as physicians and practitioners of medicine? What strikes most of us who actually do this for a living, who sit across from these couples at a desk day after day and discuss what we can do, what we can't do, and what our limitations are,
right,
is that we're not dealing with designer babies. Mm-hmm. It's a term that there are serious implications behind it, but on a day-to-day level, it's almost laughable, given the severity and the seriousness of the actual problems we're facing.
It can sound like designer genes, but of course, we don't mean it that way. But once you get involved, you are affecting the structure, the design. Dr. David Sable, I know we have to let you go. Thanks very much for joining us this evening.
Thank you.
I want to turn to calls. We have so many. Pam is on the line. Welcome, Pam. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd like to say at the outset that I'm a child and adolescent therapist. Mm-hmm. I'm a clinical social worker. I'm also a longtime environmentalist and supporter of sustainable population growth.
Okay.
And it really surprises me that in this day and age, and I see this at all levels of the socioeconomic ladder, there are still people who will continue to have children until they get the boy or the girl, even if this means having three or four children. And I can actually give you a personal example. I have a cousin who married a woman with an adult daughter, and they went on to have four children together because they were trying for the boy so they would have a son to carry on the family.
Yeah, we all know that circumstance. What are you suggesting then, Pam, in relation to genetic engineering?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, I didn't make my point at the beginning, that I actually support selecting for gender.
Why?
Because I believe that for a couple of reasons, it would...
Because you get the boy and the girl and be done and not overpopulate
the
earth?
Exactly. And also because, you know, I've seen cases, as in my cousin's case, they are, you know, poor as the proverbial church mice. They really couldn't afford to have this many children.
Mm. George Annis, I want to put Pam's point to you. Do we have to look at this in terms of even a broader ethic of global population? Is Pam suggesting there's a genetic response to a planetary problem?
Well, I actually agree we do have a planetary problem with population, but I don't think you can put that on the shoulders of individual couples or trying to have children. In the broader scheme of things, as Barbara has said, you know, IVF and screening embryos and screening eggs doesn't even show up as a a population-based societal issue. Much more important is poverty, the number of children, ability to get a job, education, et cetera.
But you can see our caller Pam is ready to put this into play, and let's charge out and use it.
I think it would have. I mean, the Chinese actually did try this with their one-child policy, right?
And I think there's been a lot of sex selection in China as well.
It's in China and India as well, both, yes. But if you only have one child, they want a boy, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we have no idea what we'd have here, but I don't think medicine has any business helping people select for non-disease traits.
But medicine has had, you know, a long history of declaring certain things diseases that then
absolutely
we retract. So they want a boy, but at one point somebody thought they had found, quote, the gay gene. Well, they did find a gene that increased the chances of a boy being gay, presumably people who are desperate to get a boy oftentimes don't want a gay one.
Correct.
And for a long time, medicine declared that was a disease. So the line drawing is just inherently more complicated than we'd like to think.
You won't let us look at this simply, Barbara Ketchoff. Julia,
I am. I want to pick up on something that David said before he got off the line, that his standards seem to be if the suffering is extraordinary, clearly defined by David himself as a doctor who faces, as he described, faces these couples every day. And, you know, just to sort of pick up on what Barbara's been saying, you know, Barbara, where would you, if a line had to be drawn somewhere in between not doing this at all and, you know, selection for the best looking child, the designer baby, is the suffering's extraordinary standard sufficient? Or,
you know, I think you have to look at what's causing the suffering. And we also have to be making a real commitment. You know, you used the example of sex selection in communities in which women are welcomed and girls are respected and lead valued lives. You get rid of sex selection. Mm-hmm. Some of the suffering that people with disabilities experience, they're very clear that they're not suffering from, you know, using a wheelchair, they're suffering from lack of access. That over and over again, some of the very conditions that are being tested for, people who have those conditions say it's not the condition, it's the society in which we're living, which isn't providing the decent support.
Let's turn to the phone lines.
We need to contextualize it. Mm-hmm.
Benedict is on the line. Welcome, Benedict. You're on the air.
Hello. I'd just like to add a brief comment.
Please.
When my wife was pregnant, when we considered amniocentesis, mm-hmm. it was actually too late to do this. It would have been somewhat dangerous to the child, and we found the gender, that it was a girl, mm-hmm. by ultrasound. So we didn't have it done, and just after birth, found she had Down syndrome, mm-hmm. and were initially horrified we're fairly well-educated, but still the neurobiology mm-hmm. lesson on Down syndrome is stupid, violent, mm-hmm. and just awful. And we've learned, she's now nearly 6 years old, that there is a lot more to it than these generalities. And
yes.
We're horrified at the thought that we might have had the amniocentesis, been told she had Down syndrome, and of course been given the suggestion to abort, since that's just a completely unlivable existence, they would say.
Benedict, your story would have to touch anyone. I had a brother who was Down syndrome, who died very young, but I understand that those choices and realities. If there had been genetic screening and you had done it, do you think you would have been prepared to say, bring her on?
I'm kind of hoping that I would have, but I'm real unsure, and that's why I'm thinking that I shudder at the thought of mm-hmm. having been faced with it.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
in some way, you're pointing out the dehumanizing aspect of even having the choice.
Yeah, and at the same time, also the prejudice. I had mm-hmm. so little idea about Down syndrome. After her birth, we learned, studied up on it, and found that what the little that we knew about it was very little.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
very
much prejudice.
Repeatedly from people who learn a lot more after they're living with a condition
mm-hmm.
and would have been making decisions based on a lot of stereotyping.
Benedict, we're very grateful to you for sharing that story, and we won't forget what you're saying, that in your daughter, with her Down syndrome, there's beauty, and you understand it, and we're grateful for that.
And there's one more detail, though.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, we're fairly well-educated, and at the idea of this child will be very limited in, shall we say, academics and such things.
Mm-hmm.
We might have said, you know, we might have been so arrogant to say that we don't want to live with that. And actually we find out that the intelligence of a child with Down syndrome is just as heavily based on the parents genetically as any other child.
Mm-hmm.
And so she is actually, in some things, she is now in kindergarten, and she is ahead of some of her normal peers.
We hear you and your new clarity on this and your love for her, and we support you. Thanks for your call, Benedict. Our time is nearly out. Barbara Katz-Rothman, sociologist at City University of New York, I want to thank you for being on with us tonight. And George Annis, professor of health law, bioethics, and human rights at Boston University School of Public Health, thank you very much for coming on. Juliet Kayyem, last thought.
This last caller, I can't help comparing to the first caller who did abort after getting some vague treatment. And, you know, for those of us who never had to experience this firsthand, I had a child just about 6 months ago. Who's right? Who's wrong? I mean, this is so personal to each individual person. And hearing, you know, the two different callers just makes that so stark.
We move into God's country there. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook.
This is WBU.